So let's keep going with our vexing conversation about rebirth a little bit. If you've been reading along last week and this week, I posted a little more in a little bit more philosophically punchy tone about the importance of the doctrines of rebirth in the Buddhist system, and how strongly they push up against some modernist belief, kind of fundamental belief systems, particularly humanism and materialism. Humanism, which to the extent that it centers humans in the cosmos, tends then to decenter other beings. So it works a little bit against the teachings on interdependence and radical interconnectedness. But the worst offender, really, in terms of rebirth, is materialistic views that suggest that only the, you know, materially measurable and reproducibly measurable phenomena are real, and therefore, because nothing can be measured around what happens to our experience of the world after we die, religious or other philosophical ideas, even non-religious ideas about any kind of continuity of consciousness or momentum of actions past the death of the body is then discounted as some kind of metaphor. This is so common that it's really throughout many of the convert Buddhist traditions, like insight meditation that I teach in, where rebirth is almost always taught as a kind of a metaphor for really psychology within this life. So what do you get reborn as? When the heart mind clings to something, you get reborn as, or you take identity with, that subject, topic, emotional state. You know, in ways that are, you know, this is not an unhelpful teaching, right? If you spend a lot of time complaining, you become kind of complainy, right? Complaining becomes not just a thing that you're doing in this moment because it's appropriate, but it becomes a habit, and then it really becomes an identity, you know? And people might be like, oh, that person, you know, they're like this, right? Or you might just feel of yourself, I always see the world in this way. I'm just a pessimist, right? That's an identity marker. That's just a label for something that you've done so much that now you've decided to just become it. So you've taken birth, we would say. So that's a kind of psychological interpretation of rebirth. So that's useful as a teaching to a certain extent. It has some philosophical flaws that don't necessarily matter as much for us, but part of what we want rebirth as a metaphor, if it is a metaphor, to do for us is to teach us how to relate to action and its effects. In the classical Buddhist teachings, the thing that rebirth is doing in the doctrine is it's a way of talking about vast stretches of time. So the human life, not very long, right? 100 years, give or take a few, at most. It's clear that actions sometimes have an effect in the very near term, which in the Buddhist sense is like in this lifetime. That's the near term for Buddhist cosmology. So, you know, you do something terrible and maybe you feel a lot of regret for it 80 years later on your deathbed, right? That would be like a near-term painful result of having broken a precept, say. But it's also clear that that some things that we do, both harmful and helpful, so good and evil, they don't actually bear palpable fruit for us in this one lifetime. So you might cheat and steal a lot of money, and you might get away with it. You know, people do. And you might die rich. You might have lots of pleasurable experiences. Justice, the long arm of the law never reaches you. Justice is never, accomplished in the way that we sometimes think of it. And, you know, the criminal dies, you know, relatively unpunished. That happens. What do you do about that, right? Does that mean that the teaching on karma, that you know, evil action always comes back to the one who does it? Is that wrong? You know, is that kind of what someone I was chatting with today about it called wishful thinking, a kind of, you know, retributional thinking? Oh, we just wish it were that way, but the universe is actually kind of random, or, you know, it just doesn't work like that. The Buddha says that it does work like that, that good action and bad action always, always, always bear fruit for the one who does them. But they clearly, and the texts say this, they don't always bear fruit in this lifetime. Conditions are super complex. It might take a long time for a certain thing to come to fruit. So rebirth, in part, is a way to really understand that the span of time across which actions unfold is actually quite vast, can be really quite vast, you know? So, the people who first dug up a bunch of coal in the English countryside and burned it, and they were like, woohoo, free stuff to burn. This is great, you know? Did they foresee that, 400 years after their lifetime, we would be in this terrible mess with the planet, like, going into tilt because of excessive burning of coal? They had no idea. But it takes long spans of time sometimes for actions to really start to bear fruit. And we don't even know what the fruit of that particular action is going to be over the long future. So rebirth is a way of saying that the things we're experiencing now may have been set in motion in the deep past. Therefore, we are connected to that deep past. And the things that we are doing now may set in motion events that won't really come to full flower into the deep future. And therefore, we are connected to that deep future. And so rebirth is a way to say we as conscious individuals are participating not just in our tiny slice of time, but in the entire span of time until we are liberated from doing so. Until we see what it means to create new karma, either good or evil. And we decide consciously to be done doing that in both kinds. And the line that has been running through my head all week as we've been kind of talking and thinking about this is a line from the texts that says, essentially, like, when you see how you've been participating in the stream of unfolding cause and effect forever, right? In this cycle of never quite accomplishing the perfection of not causing harm, you become dispassionate. You get over it. You're like, oh, I don't want to participate in this game anymore. It's like you wake up in a gambling trance and you realize that even though you sometimes win, you often lose, and the whole thing is painful. Whether you're winning or losing, it's painful. You look around the casino and it's painful, and you say, oh, I'm not playing this game anymore. And so the line is, it is enough to become dispassionate about all formations. Formations is kind of the cognitive assembly of emotional narrative that we build around experience. It's enough to become dispassionate with all formations, whether I'm winning or losing. So rebirth is a way of thinking about participating in a vast stretch of time. And the corollary to that is that it's a way of thinking about participating in a vast expanse of space, right? And the vast expanse of space is where interconnection, interdependence, interbeing lives, right? Because if we are continually reborn into different kinds of bodies, that means that all of the awarenesses that make up the world of aware beings are always kind of interchanging place, right? Reborn here, reborn there, reborn here, reborn there. One of the interesting pieces about the rebirth stories in the classical texts is that they're super relational. Like, it's not random. Whenever the Buddha tells a past life story, he says, oh, well, in this story, you know, there was a wise goose and a grieving king and an evil minister and a kind wood seller. He tells the whole story. It's got a moral. It's like a folk tale with a moral. And then he says, well, in that story, you know, monks and nuns, I was the wise goose. And, you know, my student Ananda here was the kind woodcutter. And my other student Sariputta was the grieving king. And my evil cousin Devadatta was the evil minister. The evil people are always evil in the past. The good people are always good in the past, more or less. There's a whole series of stories about how the Buddha and his wife in this lifetime, and the mother of his child, were actually intimate partners for many lifetimes before. They were gods together for hundreds of thousands of cosmic eons. They were lovers in past lives. They were also other things to each other, other kinds of familial relations. So rebirth is also a way of saying that everything that happens in this life can be explained by, not explained like in a simplistic way, but can be seen as being not random, not disconnected from the vast stream of time and the expanse of space, but that everything keeps coming into repeated contact. A Tibetan version of this same teaching is, be kind to everybody because everyone you meet has been your mother, has been your father, your sister, your brother, your lover, your partner, your child, your enemy, you know, your killer. We've all been everything else to each other. And so there's this, you know, it strips away all of the fixated identities that we might fall into in this life. Oh, this is my beloved partner, and this is my beloved child, and that's the person I really hate, and this is my beloved teacher, and, you know, but in all these past lifetimes, it's like, oh, this one, my beloved lover, well, they were actually my child in a past life. And my child, oh, this was actually my grandfather in a past life. And this was my monastic brother, you know, who knows, all the different variations. So I want to think out loud here about different types of metaphors that we might use rebirth to indicate and what it might tell us about them. And I'm going to use a structure that I sometimes use to talk about nested levels of meaning, where there's an individual layer that's the body. There's a layer out from that of relatedness, the blood family. There's a layer out from that of relatedness that is like chosen family or community, cultural affinity groups, community. A layer out from that that is unchosen, that's like the general culture that we are born into and share whether we like it or not. And then a layer out from that that I'll call ecosystem, that is beyond the species container entirely. So the classical model of rebirth is often interpreted as a body level image, or discourse would be the word. It's a description in language of a process that we could understand as being a bodily experience, right? That there's this body, and in a previous life, there was a different body. There's a connection between those, not of a soul or an essence passing, that is me somehow passing from this body to the next, but more like a momentum or a progression of force passing from one to the next, like one billiard ball striking another. They're totally separate balls. They're not the same. They don't share an identity, but they share a directional momentum. One ball rolling has force going in a certain direction, and when it strikes the other ball, it transmits some of that force to that next ball, and that ball keeps going. So on the level of body, we can think of, oh, a series of bodies. This, in a certain way, is the most literal of the ways we could understand the rebirth discourse. And it's the one that seems to inspire the most resistance in a lot of modern folks. I think that's partly because it's really confusing. Like, it's unclear what actually gets transmitted from one body to the next if there's not a soul or an essence. It's also confusing because it sounds similar to the Hindu idea of reincarnation that people are more familiar with, but it's actually kind of the opposite. In the Hindu idea, there's a soul called the Atman, the deep self or the essence, that remains eternally the same. So soul is a good word for it. But when one body wears out, it takes it off and puts on a new body like a change of clothes. That's the metaphor given in the Bhagavad Gita. So in the Hindu model, there's a soul that goes through different bodies. This is a little similar to the Christian reincarnation idea. Christians like reincarnation. They just only want you to do it once. There's a physical body, and then there's a spiritual body. So you take off the physical body and you put on the spiritual body, but there's an eternal soul. So it's similar to the Hindu version, except that it only happens once and in one direction, rather than lots of times round and round. Both of those are quite dissimilar from the Buddhist version that doesn't include the soul. The Buddha saw that it wasn't necessary to come up with that idea of there being an essence. Actually, if there was an essence, it would wreck the whole system. Because if you had an essence, it couldn't be enlightened. If your essence was already enlightened, then why practice? If your essence is already not enlightened, there's no way it can get enlightened, because the definition of an essence is that it doesn't change. So you can't. There can't be a part of you that's eternal and doesn't change, or else there would be no progress, there would be no path. So there can't be a soul. Something has to have continuity. And that continuity is continuity of force, or chi, or karma, which is force moving through time. So the bodily one is a little hard to hold. And so the individual psychology is kind of the next best for modern Buddhism. That's the common one, where the whole description of rebirth and suffering, a rebirth based on suffering, rebirth into different realms, rebirth into different bodies, is all talked about. It's all ways to talk about how we move through different psycho-emotional states in the course of one lifetime. Right? And then they just avoid the question of what happens after one lifetime. So they avoid dealing with the vast expanse of time. They just deal with the expanse of time that is this one life, and then make everything work within that one life. If you want a beautiful and helpful and convincing to some argument in favor of this, you can go find Stephen Batchelor's argument. I linked to last week under the post, I linked to Alan Wallace's traditionalist definition of defense of rebirth, and attack and unfavorable review of Stephen Batchelor's work. And then at the bottom of that essay is Stephen Batchelor's response. And they're both lovely to read. Read through them each carefully, and you might feel like each one of them convinces you while you're reading it. And that's a really great feeling, to read two sides of an argument and be well convinced by both, because they're brilliant, but they're saying very different things. So see what you make of that. All right. So moving out from body, then, the next layer out I'll think about is the family. Is family a good layer in which to think about rebirth as a metaphor? In one way, it's a lovely way to use rebirth. I was thinking about this a lot as my kid was about to be born. And I was like, oh, rebirth is just a way of talking about ancestry. You know, I'm connected in this ineffable, but, you know, completely physical and mysterious way to these two people who were my parents, of a certain sort of parents. I was adopted at birth, so I didn't know them, but they did their thing. And they had parents, and they had parents, and they had parents all the way back. And so rebirth in a certain way is, it's like, oh, well, that maybe that's a metaphorical way of talking about the endless expanse of bodies before mine that I have some connection to, right? So maybe when I feel back into, you know, my previous birth, that's a way of saying I'm feeling back into, you know, my parents, their parents, their parents. This can be a helpful metaphor. I don't think it's at all what the Buddha meant, but it can be helpful in the sense that, as you know, often quite isolated moderns, isolated from our ancestries, isolated from our heritages, isolated in a fractured post-colonial world where many heritages have been broken, wounded, harmed. It can be helpful to have any reminder that I'm connected to this stream of beings going back. And some of them were terrible humans and some of them were wonderful, and that's okay. In aggregate, what they are is a stream of force passing through bodies, creating new bodies, and that just continues. And I've done that here. I've co-created a body and, you know, just sat around watching, you know, a funny movie with him. And that's strange, right? Like, there's karma. I've done my work to continue, you know, the stream of rebirth. So we can think of rebirth as a metaphor for family ancestry. Again, in the modern psychologically oriented communities, this isn't really how it's used, but often family will be invoked again in a psychological way. So I'm carrying the wounds of my heritage, my ancestry. So here's where you'll hear about like epigenetic trauma or, you know, generational trauma. I'm this kind of man because my dad was that kind of man, because my grandfather was that kind of man, because of the war, because of, you know, all the different things. Again, I think this is a really useful way to think about our connection to the deep past and what lines of force. Trauma is a line of force passed down through the long time to us. So it's useful, I think, to think about that. Maybe that's a layer in which the rebirth story can be brought into the conversation helpfully. Going a layer out from that, there's a community layer. The family layer isn't chosen, right? You didn't choose your family. Maybe you did. I don't know. Some theologies say that you did. The Buddhist one does not say that you do. The early Buddhist one doesn't say that you do, but that karmic forces led you to them. So there's some force moving there. But a layer out from that is a layer where there is some choice. I call this community, but this is really all the kinds of chosen family or affinity community. This is where a lot of our social identities take place, right? So, you know, based on some ways I like to express myself, sometimes I use the word queer to label myself. So I'll take that as an identity. when I take that as an identity, I can go out into the world and I can meet some people and I could be like, hi, hi. And there's a meeting of, you know, a shared identity formation. That identity, of course, is a kind of birth. I've taken birth as a queer person. And whether, you know, on whatever layer of myself I understand identity discourses to live, there's a way that they point to something having come into solid being or taken birth. And so you can use rebirth discourse. Again, this is a little bit psychological, but now it's more social, social relational, to talk about how we understand ourselves, how we understand ourselves as larger groups. You know, the only way that I could understand myself as queer is if a whole bunch of noble queer ancestors had come before me, you know, invented the word, reclaimed the word, you know, had a whole liberation movement, done all of this stuff on whose shoulders I stand to be able to use such a word in such a blithe way, assured of my safety, you know, within the larger culture. All of that is karma, you know, that I'm carrying through, you know, ancestors, not of blood, but of affinity. And so again, we can use rebirth as a metaphor for the coming together or assembling of large scale bodies, we might say, you know, the body of the queer community, not an individual, but a body with certain characteristics, certain histories, certain preferences. A friend of mine in San Francisco, acquaintance really, a very sweet artist friend, Kirk Reed, wrote a book at one point called, I think, How to Be Gay. And it was like a deconstruction of, you know, how to love Liza Minnelli, and how to love certain kinds of cultural expression. And it was, you know, it was both tongue in cheek and a sincere exploration of like, how does cultural identity come into being? You know, no one person decided, hey, you know, this thing is great, we should all like this thing. But there's some things that, you know, if they are liked and that liking is expressed in a certain way, you know, your gaydar goes off. And what's up with that, right? So that's a kind of rebirth, or it's a kind of birth or a kind of body that has arisen within as a subset of the cultural body, right? It's a community level body. And it arises due to conditions, like all bodies. It changes due to conditions, it ages, it evolves. And so we can use the rebirth narrative, you know, how actions impel identities over time, to talk about cultural formation, to talk about formation of large scale identities that then family groups and bodies, individual bodies, can then participate in within larger community groups. Communities, of course, exist within the large bubble of cultures, which include things like languages, large-scale view systems, things that no one really owns and almost no individual communities can even control, right? Like who's really in charge of the English language? Or, you know, who's really in charge of American food? Tell me if you know their number. I have some complaints. But, you know, who's really in charge of, you know, patterns of dress or social mores around relationships, like big cultural themes, right? Who's in charge of racism and why are they still in charge? You know, these things are vast movements of karma involving millions of people over centuries. And, you know, something takes birth, like capitalism. And, you know, the body of those kinds of ideas or the body of those kinds of cultures has a certain birth. And again, we can, the thing that underlies all of these ways to use this as metaphor is that the teaching is always that the actions that create birth are charged actions in the ethical channel, right? So the thing that creates a birth or a body or a life or an experience that's pleasurable or, you know, comfortable is wholesome actions that help or heal, right? Lifetimes that are painful are created by actions that were harmful. One of the reasons people don't like the classical rebirth teachings is that if you take this overly literally and too simplistically, meaning that you want a direct cause for every specific experience, and the Buddha said that's not possible, for one thing, like that's not how it works, you get into a problem that it's an old medieval theological problem called theodicy, which is the problem of evil, right? So, you know, if comfortable lives come from having done good, you know, do we have to say that, like, you know, Elon Musk's relatively comfortable wealth is the result of his doing good? A classical Buddhist analysis would be like, well, yeah, in a past life, at some point, he was probably really generous. You know, he seems to have, you know, his goodness seems to have fallen on hard times, perhaps, in this lifetime. And, you know, he will get his. Like, that's how it works. And some people are like, yeah, but, like, when? You know? And the Buddhist answer is like, time is long. There's no knowing, right? Because conditions are complex. But this is a problem that's hard to solve. It's uncomfortable to try to solve. And so, so we don't like it. But the underlying mechanism of the whole system is that the actions, let's say at any level of this sequence, they bear fruit in the future, in the same level of that sequence. So, like, you know, actions of profound racial discrimination early in the colonial period, like early in the period of contact between the global North and the global South, those initial meetings, it wasn't just one. It wasn't just like one evil white guy was like, oh, I have this terrible idea. I will destroy the future. You know, it was more like, no, the prejudices that slowly accumulated in millions of people based on lots of different conditions, including poverty and war and lots of other things, sexism, slowly led to a solidifying of this thing that we now call systemic racism. And it lives at the cultural level, which is why it's so hard for even big, powerful communities to disrupt it, much less families or individuals. And so the last of the layers is the ecosystem layer, where the actions taken are, in a certain way, the composite the composite of the actions of, maybe we want to say all the sentient beings in that system. So in our Earth system, that includes not just the humans, but everyone else, all of the animals and spirit beings and complex life forms that are here. And maybe we could say that the whole Earth as a kind of being, this is the Gaia hypothesis, the whole Earth as a kind of being has its own karmic trajectory and is experiencing the results of its actions, you know, in some like super large scale kind of way. Yuval Harari's book, Sapiens, is a little bit about this. It's still too human focused, but it looks at, you know, the actions of humans from the very, 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 very distant evolutionary past and how we might still see them operating here. And so we can feel into then all these different layers of how we might understand our place in the cosmos over long stretches of time. And just ask, you know, in what way do we know ourselves beyond this body's lifetime? In what way do we have access to the long time, the long stream of time? And then just see where that question leads. Maybe it leads really into, you know, dream time kinds of, you know, mystical processes. Maybe it leads into kinds of deep meditation that unfold as something that you would say, oh, this is the past life meditation. I'm understanding my presence in the deep past in this way. Maybe it unfolds specifically in one of those layers, maybe because there's information there or a felt sense there that's helpful for you, you know? Like you go in looking for individual past lives and you get a hit about your family's ancestry. Or you go in looking for family ancestry and you get a hit about what it means to be human at this point, but maybe at one point to have been mammoth. Or even to know something about the connection between mammoth sentience and human sentience. Because I think we can know that. There's certainly people around who know that, you know, in the same way that there's people around who know the connection between, you know, their deep blood ancestor consciousness and their own, or between tree spirit consciousness and their own. All of those layers, folks have given their lives to understand this, because I don't think we are able to rest in our hearts with the sense of ourselves being isolated, separate, disconnected experiences. It just doesn't ring right in so many ways. And so rebirth is one way of describing how we might feel into our participation in the cosmos. And so then an encouragement to not take it too literally, but also not dismiss it too quickly. And just ask the question, in what way do I understand myself as participating in the long story?